Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday,
1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time,
and you're listening to the Views with your host, Avenger Satanus,
and the Beast.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm T.C. Downey, and this is my co-host, Avenger Satanus. Avenger, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm happy to be back in the world of my normal surroundings. I spent last week, as you know, buried in very long and boring, conferences that spanned from 8 a.m. in the morning to 11:30 at night.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy, especially when it's 5 days straight. It's
wow.
Brutal, man. And this last time around wasn't nearly as brutal as it has been the previous 10 times before that. What's that?
This is something you do every year?
Yeah, actually it was twice a year up until the recession began, and then they shrank it back down to one time a year. It's something that unfortunately comes with the occupation in which I am now currently am working in, and you wouldn't think that these fireworks companies would really have that kind of necessity, but they, in fact, in particular, the company I work for, they're global power. So
yeah, that's
it's at least in that industry.
Yeah.
I don't know how familiar with fireworks you are, but there's two companies that most people think of when they think of fireworks, either TNT or Phantom Fireworks.
Okay.
And I work for the last one I mentioned, Phantom Fireworks. One of the things that made these meetings less grueling for me was the fact that I've really gotten good at focusing my attention. I've really gotten good at projecting my attention for, big distances. These conference rooms aren't small. I'm guessing they're probably in themselves a good 6,000 or 7,000 square feet.
That's big.
That is big. And when you're hard of hearing like me, that kind of a gap between you and who's speaking can be detrimental.
Right, right. So do you try to sit front, or do you just sit wherever you can, or do you not really worry about that?
I try to sit middle, actually, is more of what I go for. Because if you sit in the back, the bosses look at you like you're a slacker, and you don't want to interact and be connected, but if you sit up front, your coworkers look at you as you being an ass kiss, and that's not a good thing either. So I usually aim for the middle, which means that I have upwards of 3,000 or 4,000 square feet worth of space between me and the speaker up front, and laterally that's only 50 or 60 feet, but that's still enough to really make it difficult, especially given the type of hearing loss that I have, where I'm missing particular frequencies over overall sound.
Right.
There's some sounds I hear better than the average person, and there are other sounds, I don't hear at all. So, it's
so I
actually
assume
this,
Go ahead.
Oh, please.
Oh, I assume that this little anecdotal segue is getting us to our main topic today, which is meditation and trance states?
It certainly is. It's my heavy use of meditation and trance states that's actually enabled me to project my focus, my attention, the distance necessary to make it actually seem like the speaker in front of me is within a matter of a couple of feet from me. And it takes an extreme amount of focus to make it happen, but once you're there, it's pretty easy to maintain.
Okay. So you're paying strict attention to whoever's speaking, and what the rest of the world just kind of like falls away while you're hyper focused on the person in front of you and what they're saying.
That's exactly right. I always kind of want to parallel it to those scenes in Alice in Wonderland where it's like a spotlight just on Alice and all the rest of it's black around her.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that's what happens in my mind. My attention focuses like that and everything else just goes completely black. And in that, I'm actually able to transcend the physical space between us. And so it brings it right up to me, and I can hear completely what's being said, and I can understand. I mean, I always knew that before a lot of my hearing was based on visual, but now that I understand entirely that I have to put very heavy emphasis on the visual focus of it, it seems to be working really well.
Right, to make up for any shortfall you have in the hearing department, or, I assume you pick up on, body language and facial expressions and just cues on movement and whatever the speaker is trying to relay.
Right.
So do you do this without being, in a big auditorium with, one person in front of you and a whole bunch of people around you?
How my world goes now. Yes, I'm able to actually, if I'm intently focused on what somebody's saying and they're not boring me, then, yeah, I can shut absolutely everything out but them.
Yeah.
And that actually really gives us a big doorway into today's topic. Because what I'm actually doing is I'm inducing a trance state.
Mm-hmm.
And
is this something that you think people do, all the time, without realizing it?
Oh, certainly.
So it's something we all do at different times in our lives or different times of the day or the week, depending on circumstances.
Last weekend, my son was really, really heavily playing with his Legos, and he's got really good hearing, really good eyesight, all around he's really healthy, which I'm happy about. But I was talking to him, and I was literally standing beside him and talking directly down at him, and I'm not a very quiet person, at least in terms of speech, but yet he was absolutely and totally so fixated on constructing this tower out of Legos that he completely and totally didn't even, recognize that there was a sound coming. And this is just a demonstration of what we're talking about here, these trance states. People go through shifts of consciousness, probably as many times as they take a breath in a day.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think that sort of begs the question, how important is it to consciously be aware and direct these states of trance, these states of consciousness, that we have, these mental projections or awareness, is it going to screw us up or make us miss out on important things if just mechanically we allow our consciousness to go in and out of focus on one thing or another, as opposed to directing it with will and consciously managing it?
Well, I think, and this has actually become part of my overall philosophy, but in terms just here, I think that it's important for people to realize that they've got to consistently be asking themselves two questions. The first is, what exactly is it that they want? What exactly is it that they are trying to achieve in this particular point? And it doesn't really matter whether it's reaching for that piece of pizza or, something much more deep, like actually trying to put yourself into a deep meditative state. You have to have a clear intent and focus in all things. And that direction in itself will help to better guide you through things, because then you become aware of when it's time to shift to the singular focus that I'm talking about, and when it's time to allow your perception or your vision of, field of perception to broaden and take in the whole picture. I find that people in general, they either go one or the other way. They're either so intently focused on one particular function or feature, or they're just completely unfocused and just paying attention to everything abroad and not really focusing on what they're doing. And what happens is, if you're doing something that presents some element of danger to you, then this is a period in time in which you need to have the singular focus. And those people who are programmed to have that wider spectrum of focus, they're more prone to actually having accidents happen to them. You see it on the road every day. You see, two cars that have collided, and undoubtedly, one of the people is saying, "I wasn't paying attention."
Right. Do you think that, it seems to me that a certain level of either danger or the unknown can sharpen focus, and it just lets us know that, like, oh shit, I better pay attention, because something may happen. Like, it brings us out of our everyday routine, and it, like we talk about with the work all the time, how we're living automatically, in a mechanical sense. We're asleep in sort of a prison-like state, because we're just the universe's bitch all the time. So certain experiences, certain times when there's danger present or something very strange or unknown, I think that allows us to snap out of our usual state into something where we're more aware, we're more concerned about what's going on and what could potentially happen in the near future, things like that.
Sure. I think that's really been an understood principle, even dating far back as Plato. Plato was acutely aware that the actual essence of the person was really truly at its most primal and pure state in the face of danger. And that's because you have this recognition process that goes on, which is, I don't want that to happen, or that's not me. That's that period in time in which you're actually realizing that, this point in time is pivotal and important.
Yes. So, inducing states, that seems like that's of the keys to gaining this sort of heightened consciousness or hyper awareness.
Certainly. And that actually leads into the second question, but I'll let you finish.
Okay. I was just going to mention something that I've been implementing in my own lifestyle, my own regimen, is a book called The Warrior Diet. And I'll just give you the very briefest of synopsis of the book. Basically, you eat very little during the day. You sort of go in and out of like hunger states. You kind of remain, I guess, on the edge of hunger, like more or less throughout the day. And then at night, you kind of have a larger meal, you know, a big feast or whatever. And then, you know, you go to sleep, and then you wake up and you do the exact same thing. And it kind of mimics how, like, the warriors and ancient peoples of, like, Greece and Rome and things like that used to operate. One of the reasons, besides it just being more natural to us, is that when you're hungry, it sort of creates more of a warrior mindset, where you're more alert, you're more awake, you kind of... there's a little bit more urgency or aggression in your behavior. Your senses seem to be a little bit more heightened, and because I think it activates a certain signal of possible danger in the near future, because, you know, you're hungry, and, you know, that just triggers certain things. Because it's, you know, a biological process of, if you're hungry, you want to eat. And, you know, if you keep going hungry, then you're just going to starve and die. So,
right.
In a very small way, it kind of activates, you know, sort of like a fight or flight response. And of course, religious people throughout the ages have used, like, fasting to induce trance states and to enhance meditation and things like that.
Certainly, it speaks directly. I'm sorry.
Oh, I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. I mean, that's what it's actually doing, at least from my standpoint, is it's invoking the primal state of man, the true nature of man. I think part of what keeps us asleep as a society is the lack of the lack of urgency in the departments of feeding and shelter. You know, those things are already established for you. Those luxuries are already there, and so the through just taking advantage of the fact that, you know, you can eat at any point in time that you want, so long as you have the cash flow for it, and you can lay down and sleep in your bed and know that, the rains aren't going to fall on you or the winds aren't going to give you a chill. You know, you kind of, you lose the connection with nature that man is meant to have.
Right. So I think what you're trying to say is, like, having too comfortable and cushy a lifestyle up to a certain point could be a detriment because, you know, you're too cushioned by your wealth, by all the things you own, your luxuries, and it buffers you against the rigors and the hardships of everyday life. And I think to some degree you need that. You know, you need life to, you know, kick you around a little bit, or at least have the potential to do that, in order to really feel alive and connect with this horrible universe on a very intimate level.
I absolutely agree, and that's precisely what I'm getting at. It you need to keep that sense of urgency, that primal sense of urgency in your system of personal logic and function. Otherwise, you just begin to drone in this kind of state of mundane oversatisfaction. It's really kind of funny when you look at all of the religions that have warned against this, against gluttony and sloth, and the reasons that they warn against it is because you become sedimentary.
Yeah, well, that's funny because it seems with the whole seven deadly sins, which you just brought a couple examples of, there seems to be a push pull there. There's sloth and gluttony and things like that, but then there's also lust and pride and wrath, which kind of motivates you and creates a sense of urgency as well.
Sure. I mean, the ancient people, they lived in a world that was more natural. And so they still had a connection with these primal things, and so the natural balance that's presented between these concepts, it was just kind of a built-in portion of their logic.
Right. Hang on. We got a caller. Oh, my God.
Okay.
Hello.
Hey, caller.
Hello. How are you guys?
Good. How are you?
Hey, not too bad. I just
a great topic, and so
exactly.
And help what did you want to talk about?
I was wondering, would you guys think about briefly, not trying to delve into anything, too intellectual, just something I thought of kind of on the spot about the cosmos. Do you think the cosmos, say, is ordered or was ordered and is now like chaotic, and we're chaotic as a result? Or that's the reason why the world isn't so much kind of trauma, Or do you think there is a natural order? And do you still think that there is any kind of natural order? Or do you think, the opposite of the cosmos?
Okay. That's a good question. Do you want to take that, Zeno, first, or do you want me to go first?
I'll let you go first, man.
Okay.
Fuck you guys. I wasn't sure exactly how to state it, but...
No, I think I know what you mean. After I go into a little bit of my belief system, let me know if that's on target with what you're saying.
Sure.
Well, going back to my own ideas of the origins of things, of the universe and the world and man, I believe that this universe was created and is ruled by... certain forces or beings, which I call the lesser gods. And basically it's set up as a fuel source. And our suffering just kind of nourishes these lesser gods. And there is an order to it.
That sounds like a lot like what I've been reading in on Gnosis, on Gnosticism. Because they believe a lesser demiurge or almost an evil, well... That's very vague to say evil. That's very maniacal and kind of stupid.
I would say hostile to mankind.
Hostile to mankind. That's good.
for all intents and purposes, most people regard that as evil. But
getting away from
moral, duality, I think. Well, I did borrow a lot of the cult's paradigm and a lot of my own belief systems from Gnosticism and other older religions that sort of interrelate.
It is really old, from 2 AD, apparently. So
it is,
I
think even before the time of Jesus, people sort of realized that, hey, the world kind of sucks, but human beings do have a certain advantage. We evolved with a sense of consciousness, which all the other animals on Earth... don't have.
But see, that brings up an interesting predicament, because some people think, well, call them just blatant New Age spiritual pseudo-hippies, I don't know, whatever you'd like to, I don't know where I was going with that exactly, but a lot of these people, they think, oh, well, animals, you know, they're so, like, they're more evolved than us, like, spiritually, and we have to tap into their conscious, you know, like that kind of stuff. I'm sure you've heard something like that from,
I usually
you know,
don't come into contact or have discussions with people that are that into the hippie, you know, white light Wiccan culture,
yeah.
But I guess I've heard stuff like that before.
It's interspersed throughout a lot of different kinds of, like, there's New Dimensions Radio on iTunes, for example. You may have heard,
okay,
listening to that. There's, you know, and they have some great, great stuff, but coupled, of course, with a lot, tons of what you would, you know, of course, call New Age stuff. But, yeah, I was just wondering what you guys thought. Okay. Does Zeno have anything to say about the whole cosmos kind of, you know, deal?
I have a ton to say, and I'm trying to think of how to
great,
how to compress it to a point that it's going to be understandable, but yet not be
don't
too intensive.
I'll zip thy lip.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
All right. Well, my view is that these entities that that Derek's referring to are actual different types of an energy current. That construct larger organisms that we really don't have an understanding of. One of the things that we've learned from chaos theory and chaos magic is that even though it appears to be chaos, there is actually a system working within it. It's just a system that isn't understood at first glance or sometimes even after a very intrinsic look.
Mm-hmm.
So in my mind...
Because it's the spark, right? It's kind of like the spark that ties into... I just keep thinking of Gnosticism again. Because, you know, there's the good wrapped inside the evil of the world. That's kind
right.
of like a little theory of Gnosticism, you know?
Well,
and that's what
unfortunately,
it sounds like. Until you notice that spark, you don't know it, you know?
Right.
So you,
and unfortunately, what's happened is we're so set on these dualistic principles of good and evil, black
yeah.
and white, night and day, that we don't understand that they're both contained within the same field. They are mirror opposites of the exact same thing. They are
yeah.
opposite attributes that go to the exact same organism.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the need for a scapegoat and a martyr, you know, like you have to have the bad person, have the good person, the hero and the villain, you know. But then there's like the dark hero and the good villain, you know. That kind of...
Right.
There are some artistic kind of ambiances like from dualism that kind of spark, I think, an artistic flame, kind of like something that gets it going, inspirational, you know?
Right.
That's kind of I think you kind of need some dualism. Just
that dualism is naturally existent, and
yeah.
you know, no matter what we do, we can't remove that. But by making an observation of that dualism, by beginning to understand that we live by a cause equals effect principle, we're in turn actually creating a third principle and building a trinity of ourselves in that manner.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
I think that's
indeed.
Pretty important. Every time I hear, you know, the word duality or I start thinking in terms like that, I try to remember the work and bring in the third force. The third side, the neutralizing factor, the reconciling force, which
the all-knowing
sure,
world ones, I guess, for
yeah,
for you guys.
The positive and the negative, the push and the pull together, and create something new, it raises it up to not the natural mechanical level that we're used to dealing with,
yeah.
but a heightened conscious,
a mix of both, kind of?
Willful and directed side.
Oh, wow. That's very interesting.
Now, I've actually, I've completed some posts on the Cthulhu Cult's Pro Board, the forum, which deal directly with the dualistic principles and then how it builds into our Trinity, and then beyond that, how we then come into what I call the fourth dimension. So if you're interested, you can go on there. It's within my last 10 posts, so you just click on my profile name, and you can quickly
right.
follow through with
so
my
I'm
thinking
just
on that.
Really quickly about this, like about like a fourth dimension, or you know, say like the fourth way. do you think that from a new dimension happening because of the fourth way, you know, like the, or the, I guess you could say what, Venture, you said the third point, you know, above like this side and that side, the third point, like
right.
you,
right.
do you think, but say a multi, like kind of like a multivalence of dimensions could occur just as a result of that one separation?
Yes, I do.
And by that, I mean
I
like a bunch of different kind of societies, sort of. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I think
not exactly secret societies, but
right.
that word society
I think you can
is
pick
always
anything.
Like.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, let me answer your question. And,
yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. I think it doesn't matter what it is. Anything that you can think of, anything that you can do or conceptualize, it could be taken on a higher superior level. Like let's say you don't know if you want an apple or an orange. Well,
take both, put them in a blender.
You know,
it seems
most likely that you could combine the apple and orange and have them both.
Right.
And that in the simplest terms is I think what we're doing basically when you bring in a third choice or a third force, you're creating a new dimension of a lot of things, of experience, of consciousness, of reality.
Right.
So
that makes sense to me. Yeah.
Like any time in your life, I think you can look at things from a third side perspective and try to go above the average mean, you know, of people.
Do you believe, like, in that law that, like, really quick, like, the last thing, like, kind of like this threefold law, like, whatever you put out there, but say, like, whatever you put out there, like, say if you think about it too much or brood over it, do you think, like, as in, say, a traditional witch would think, like, if you think about it too much, it will never happen. You know, hey, if you pine over it, you're going to lose it. You're going to lose the mojo, you know? You know, like, think like too much about some things that you want.
I think that's difficult to say. I think it's a double-edged sword because you know, I have heard a lot about, you know, not having what they call a lust for result and, you know, not worrying about things all the time. But at the same time, you get out what you put in. And the more thought, the more energy, you know, the more work you put into something, the more you're going to get out of it. But I think that it's going back to the third side again. I think you've got to find a balance between those. I think you've got to
stay separated, but stay integrated too. In a
exactly. Kind of, it's just like working out. You know, you've got to, when you're at the gym, you've got to work your ass off for like, you know,
right.
an hour at a time. But then you got to take time off. And you gotta rest, and you gotta recover, and
take your protein.
You gotta not go back to the gym, and you know if you're training chest and triceps on Monday, don't go back and train chest again until at least Friday.
Yeah.
You gotta give it plenty of time.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Because if you're going there every single day and you're working your chest, you know you're gonna overtrain,
right?
And you're not gonna be able to grow.
It'll
and,
be all boost and no back.
Rest. Exactly. Yeah.
Hey, well, thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for answering my questions, guys. That was cool.
Yeah,
was really...
I appreciate you calling in, man.
Yeah, no doubt.
We'll hear from you again soon.
Absolutely. I'll try. Because I had a little bit of a departure from the last couple of weeks, you know, whatever it was, due to just – I don't think it was oversleeping. I mean, that's just terrible if I'm sleeping that late. But I think I just kind of – I don't know if I forgot. I think I was out doing things. Yeah, Saturday I'm usually out doing some stuff. But,
yeah,
I'll be sure to try and call in again, though. Absolutely.
That sounds sweet, man. All right, see you.
All right, see you guys later. Take care.
Bye.
It's actually interesting because the last bit of that conversation was talking about getting results. And the second part of the two questions that I said was in relation to trance and meditation is not only do you have to, you know, first you know, get an understanding of what you're trying to achieve. But secondly, you need to have a mental visualization or, you know, a definition of how to know when you've obtained what you were trying to achieve.
Right. Visualization is pretty key.
Right. So, I mean, what's really come to fold here is, like, say, for instance, I want to induce myself into a meditative state. Well, how do I know when I've reached this meditative state? Well, I already have a preconceived notion of where I will be when I've reached that state. Otherwise, it's kind of, it's defeated from the beginning.
Right. Right. Although people's preconceived notions can be wrong, but yeah, overall, I think, yeah, you got to have goals, and you got to try to visualize achieving those goals.
Certainly. Well, I'm not saying that getting to that end result is what's actually going to happen. But what I'm saying is that, you know, you've set this point in your mind that you want to reach. And if during this process you never reach it, well, then you're now able to start rationalizing why it is that you didn't reach it and what actually did take place. And maybe your direction
right.
is off. And, I mean, so, you know, having that preconceived state is more important than actually reaching it.
Right. Well, let's focus on meditation. What kind of results do you usually want to achieve when you meditate?
For me, it's a very large variable. Sometimes I'm reaching for longer spans of intense consciousness or intense focus. Other times I'm reaching for a more peaceful or tranquil state. Other times it's trying to just work a problem out, you know, something that maybe I can't seem to wrap my conscious mind into enough to actually figure it out. But if I just, you know, let go and let the internal mechanisms work and just watch them, I can generally find, you know, the answer to what I was looking for. Sometimes I'll go into a meditative state while I'm actually working out. And, you know, that's because I'm trying to jump from 25 repetitions to 50. And, you know, I've got to create more momentum and more strength to go to my arms or my legs or whatever muscle group I'm working with. I mean, there's a million things that really that I try to get to when I'm going into a meditative state.
Yeah, I totally understand about the mental state you need to get into when you're working out and when you're training with weights and free weights and machines and things like that. You've got to get yourself into the right mind state in order to push yourself enough to get results and have it make a difference. Tear down those muscles so then they can rest and grow and get larger and stronger.
Yeah, I mean, and it's all very consciously done. I mean, that's one thing that I'll give the bodybuilder over the common man, is that he is very very conscious about what areas he's working on and why.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of a systematic approach to everything, and it requires those two questions that I posed in the beginning to be answered.
Right. Well, do you ever go into a gym and see those people that are just weight training or lifting or doing cardio or whatever mechanically?
I do see them doing it mechanically.
I mean, that, yeah, obviously that was a rhetorical question, I hope, for everyone listening, because, yeah, because if you actually pay attention, you see that a lot. I think whenever I'm at the gym, 9 out of 10 people are just kind of going through the motions, and they're not.
Right, and those are the people that are actually not gaining, like the people who
exactly.
are conscious about what they're doing.
Right. I mean, sure, it's better than nothing. It's better than just sitting in front of the TV eating potato chips, but you're not going to make any substantial progress just, you know, curling 20 pounds for 15 reps and then stopping before it gets really, really difficult. Or people that don't have good form. Like, I see people, you know, trying to do bicep curls, and they're, like, doing a whole body curl. It's, you know, it's ridiculous. You know, they're doing everything except straining or putting intensity into the bicep itself. So, obviously, that's not going to gain them any results. It's just...
Right. Well, what that, in my opinion, what that actually amounts to is... rather than a conscious effort, it's a mimicked effort. It's doing
right.
something because you think that that's what you're supposed to be doing, and you're only willing to put the minimal effort into it to
right.
do it. And why do anything if you're not going to do it to be successful?
Right. I think there is some advantage to mimicking or modeling certain people. Like, I know Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he was very, very young, modeled, I think, Reg Park. He saw him in magazines, and he read interviews, and he learned everything he could about this guy. And everything that this guy did, he did. And obviously, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger was one of the top bodybuilders, you know, in the entire world for a long time. So... you know, that works. But I think, you know, no matter, and Schwarzenegger learned, like, the whys and wherefores eventually, too, and, like, you know, why you should be doing this and how this result comes. But so I think it's okay to mimic and model other people, but you got to
be done with passionate
intent.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not in a mechanical way, not just, you know, in an automatic way, going through the motions, you know, sleepwalking through your workout routine. That's not gonna get you very far.
So, all of this discussion on trance states and meditation, it leads to what I would like to say is a bigger question, and that is, what methods actually work. Is there any particular? Pardon me.
You mean for meditating and inducing trance, or for what?
Yeah, all of that. Meditating, inducing trance. Yes. What methods actually work? What methods do you use?
Well. Okay. Yeah, that is a good question. I think having a goal, visualizing that goal, gaining information on how to reach that goal, putting in the time and effort to actually make it happen, trying to do things as consciously as possible, with a will and an intensity that could scare or frighten the average person. And then once you've done everything you can for a certain period of time or certain session or whatever, then back off a little bit and rest and maybe leave it alone and not think about it for a while, and then come back to it when you're fresh again.
Okay, so we can put that into I'm trying to think of how to actually break that down. I mean, it makes perfect sense, but for somebody who's never meditated before, it would be difficult to...
I think that could be done with anything, though. I mean...
Oh, certainly, but what I'm trying to do here is is build a picture for the people who have never actually had this experience as
right.
to, you know, how this applies to the experience. And I think what's going on here is you're answering those questions and then you're following through and trying it out. And if your, you know, results didn't meet the measure of what, you know, you anticipated or visualized that it would be in the end, you know, you're going back and trying again, and maybe this time from a different angle. Or let's say you did get the results that you wanted, but now you know that you can push it even further.
Right. Now that I think about it, I think I was answering a different sort of question than you had asked regarding strictly about meditation. I would focus on self-remembering, I guess, on being here and now in the present moment, being mindful of my own present state, my different centers, physical, emotional, intellectual, and try to, you know, just as long as I possibly can, be truly conscious and awake and aware of myself and what's going on around me, like right now, at the present moment. That, I think, is the first step to any productive kind of meditation.
And I can't disagree. What I can say, though, is that the process that you're describing is really not limited in its application. As a matter of fact, it's probably the most pliable philosophy of how to go about meditating. And by what I mean by this is I've experimented with actually using different sound frequencies, color frequencies, and those in combination. But the whole time I'm doing this, I'm paying close attention to what my own physical and psychological reaction is to what I'm doing.
Right.
I'm kind of losing what direction I was going with this.
That's good, though. I think you can use not only colors and sounds, but shapes and symbols or even magical sigils to induce different kind of trance states and get various results through, you know, meditating on a certain thing. You know, because of course that's very closely aligned with magical states and working magic. Is there any particular color or type of sound
what I was actually doing is I found a set of videos on YouTube a while back that had these different frequencies of sound that were supposedly directly related to particular chakras of the body. And it becomes very easy in my mind if I'm working with, you know, the pituitary chakra to associate the color green with it, just by the nature of the actual chakra that I'm working with and the nature of the experience that I have personally with the color green. So I think that it's a very organic method in that, you know, the same things that work for me may or may not yield the same results that work for you. You know, I found myself personally that long periods of sound versus broken up periods of sound work better. So, for instance, if I'm working with frequency 528 megahertz, I want long, even pulses rather than actually having like a more musical nature to it. So, but this is just because I think, you know, when we are going with like these meditative audios and stuff, and you're listening to, you know, this kind of serene melody that's going, it's more of a lull you to sleep type thing rather than forcing you to recognize and separate yourself from the currents of energy passing through you.
Sure. I think we've used sort of neuro-linguistic programming ideas with the color green in the Cthulhu cult to a point where sometimes if you're just thinking about the color green, or you're seeing it, or you're writing about it, there's a very vivid association with the cult of Cthulhu. You know, we talk about, you know, a green flame and the Emerald Kingdom and, you know, the Chartreuse Void and
the Harlequin High Priest.
Exactly, the Harlequin High Priest, exactly. So I think what we've done is we've consciously tried to make these strong neurological and linguistic associations with different shades of green and what we're doing. You know, our whole paradigm, our whole religion through the Cthulhu cult. So I think that makes it easier to use the color green, to use that hue to induce trance states and to meditate on in order to effectively use magic. You know, we even call it Bridian magic. So it's
right. We've definitely
has a very strong presence. It has a sort of alien quality, and you know, a certain vitality and multi-dimensionality. I think there are so many different hues of green that, you know, just many different kinds and layers and values and dimensions. And I think it's one of the most open-ended and versatile colors. So, I just wanted to mention that.
I think you're absolutely correct. And, you know, one of the downsides to this show is that we often find ourselves in complete agreement with things. And so, you know, it seems like sometimes, you know, the learning curve is capped off by that. But I think overall what it's really demonstrating is the actual accuracy of what we talk about. When we both come to a point in which one says to the other, I agree with what you're saying, you know, that kind of lends its self to the validity of it.
Yeah. At times it would be nice to have someone that violently disagreed with us, but on the whole, I think if we had that for a full hour, that would really become tiresome and counterproductive. So
it could well.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately,
eye to eye more often than not.
Right. Well, what I really think is going to happen, and I think we're going to see a lot of this next week in Jason King's show, is we're going to learn, everybody who's listening is going to learn that the true barriers of language. And I think that we're going to find ourselves at some points in our conversation with Jason King having to say, wait a minute, we don't agree with this, or we do agree with this, but you're looking at it from the wrong angle, and you know, that's where all the subjectivity is going to come in, and you're going to see that language's subjective nature in itself is detrimental to what's actually going on.
Right. There's probably going to be a lot of misunderstanding, because not only that is that the nature of language, but that's just the nature of the world, that people don't understand each other. People have a hard time effectively communicating, especially when you get up to certain ideas like philosophy and religion and reality, talking about stuff like that. It's just difficult because, you know, that's just one of the laws working against us in this universe. It's very difficult for people to understand each other. But we're going to work super hard to, you know, try to understand each other and see eye to eye. And so, yeah, next week should be a great show, talking to Jason King about postmodern Satanism. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, I am, too. I mean, there's a lot of things that my own personal philosophies and Mr. King's philosophies where they parallel, and then there's this point where I say, well, except for, and then it begins, you know.
Right.
So it should definitely be interesting, but this in itself has kind of got its own natural meditative or trance-induced function. You know, we build ourselves up with this perception of how everything should be, and we then begin to commit this thing called solipsism, which you're very familiar with. It's one of the satanic sins, you know, and that's projecting your own thought processes, projecting your own ideas onto another person and making the assumption that they think and process things the same way you do.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I try not to assume that people see the world through my eyes. I try to give them the benefit of the doubt that they're seeing things on a lower level. And that's not to make it sound like, you know, I'm better than other people are. But I try to see things in a more conscious way. And that's only through my training and the work, the fourth way, and Gurdjieff and Ostrensky's teaching that allows me to do that. And try to teach people to do the same thing, and hopefully, eventually, some of it rubs off on people, and they can live a little bit more consciously than they otherwise would.
Yeah. Well, we've got about a minute left in the show, a little more than a minute left in the show, and I just wanted to make mention that I've posted a challenge for people on YouTube, and I'd like to encourage everybody to think of this as a meditative exercise and go through with it.
And what's the name of your channel? Beast Zeno?
Yeah, it's youtube.com / Beast Zeno.
That's spelled with an X, everybody.
Right, X-E-N-O.
Yeah. Well, cool.
One word.
I plan on doing a video with using the same words, and hopefully other people do too.
Right. And in the future, when we get the chance to come back around to this, I will undoubtedly explain why it's important to use the exact same words, and maybe even try to mimic the same tones. But we're running out of time today, man. So
yep.
Let's wrap this shit up and call it a day.
All right. Sounds good. See you guys later.
See you later.